Thanks so much. You know, we had some trouble in the airport this morning. The plane was late, and then when we arrived to Boston, they were calling us to take the connection to Aruba. And it was so difficult to convince Jill to come actually here, not to go to Aruba. And, so, you know. And then she starts with this idea about how truth and reconciliation are needed in the Caribbean. That so I'm trying to say, yeah, but anyway.
They need
me
in
Boston
too.
Yeah. She keeps harping about the dolphins and all that. And what can we do? So anyway, we're just starting 15 minutes late, so it's not that bad. The idea was, or at least my idea was, to raise a few generative questions about the sense of looking for the truth of something as complex as a historical event. And so what I wanted to do was to first lead a short reflection on what is it, this concept we use so liberally every day, about what is true and what is not true. And in what way do we conceive the truth when we are talking about a social event, something that happens between people with different perceptions? And I wanted to explain why is it that this discussion is so important and so relevant in terms of social change. Because I do think that a discussion about what is true of social events is not of plainly academic interest, but it has a clear political resonance and a political content. So it's important to know why. And finally, since you guys want to land this discussion somewhere in some practical form, I wanted to raise the question of how. So how do you go about reconstructing the truth about a given event? So the interesting thing about the term truth is that it's very unclear to know what is true about it. You think of it. Usually, we talk about the truth as if true was that saying, that narrative, that explanation we give that corresponds to the world out there. It's sunny. That's true. Right? It's Saturday. That's true. It's 10 a.m. in the morning. That's true. But when you start to interrogate that, you realize that in reality, it's not that the world is sunny objectively aside of us. It's that we call that kind of day sunny. We are using conventions. It's not that the light that falls at a certain angle on the planet is divided naturally in 24 exactly equal parts. It's not that. That is a convention we have invented in order to do what? Well, to coordinate our actions, to start the seminar at the same time. That's the only reason we have a watch. And when we refer to the truth, well, we have all these different conceptions playing. If this glass were to fall, that would be an event, a physical event, and we could probably describe this in the same way. But when we don't talk about a glass falling or the sun shining, when we talk about actions, it's far more complicated. Made the experiment of going out to any random place in this country and ask people, so who is right? Speaker Boehner? Yeah. Or President Obama? I mean, come on, the truth is one, right?
Yes.
So you should have one answer. Well, welcome to the world. That doesn't exist. Because then we realize speaking about what is truth about a social event is far different of what is truth about a physical event. Our conventions to think about the physical world are more common. We all share them. We don't share the same conventions about the social world. And so, while we can all agree in the convention that we are going to divide the day in 24 equal segments, we do not agree on other issues. We do not agree on how should we divide and classify people, for example. How should we allocate resources in a given city? We cannot agree on that because we have different concepts of what is true about that. Some people believe that the truth is that people who are laborious and able and astute get rich and they deserve that. And some people have different truths about what determines you being rich or poor, fortunate or unfortunate. So it is a concept that, as you can see, is incredibly political. And you can even see that when you discuss about your own personal experience. When I ask you, so what is true, right? What was your first school? Or you can complexify this, what was really your dad's attitude about you? Or, so why did you break up with him or with her? Right? Let me ask him. Look, in complete honesty, two people can tell me two entirely different stories. They can go to the same therapist, in fact. And the therapist is going to say, I don't know which one is the truth, because probably it is irrelevant. The point is that we should be very careful of thinking that the truth is one thing, that is kind of the solid reflection, a mirror of the world. And we should probably be a little bit more relativistic here, not in a cynical way, and recognize that when we talk about the truth, particularly about a social fact, we're talking about a certain narrative. A narrative we agree on. And a narrative, frankly, that we have constructed in some way. Not all social truths have been constructed by we all here. Some of them we inherit. And some of them keep changing. No, probably if we were not in Boston, but somewhere in the Louisiana or in Alabama, we could be having now quite different stories about the past of this nation. It's perfectly possible. Because we inherit certain truths, certain constructions. And so then there is this very stark distinction between what we experience as the truth, we as individuals, and what we hear is the truth in a given society. Because we have this experience that our truth as individuals, our personal truth, is based on our memory. And that is undeniable. I clearly remember seeing UFOs when I was 8 in a beach in Peru. My cousins say that never happened. Yeah. I remember being with them and seeing the UFO. I don't believe in UFOs now, but I clearly remember that I saw something that looked like a UFO moving in a funny way, hovering over the beach. What am I going to do? You see? What am I going to do with that memory? I mean, that memory exists. And I was not 3, I was not 4, I was 8, so it's not really completely an invention or anything. So, and it's, you know, that's just a banal, trivial example. You can think of more or closer examples to your life, right? So, I have divorced 5 times, so the first time I divorced, So this is the thing, your memories are a close part of yourself. So you cannot accept that somebody is going to come to you and say, no, that memory is erroneous. No, you were really never the victim of this particular injustice in this society, because that was not an injustice. You're fine. Why are you complaining? Nobody can do that to you because your memory is part of yourself. But the problem is, we don't live in islands by, you know, ourselves in little individual niches. And we have to have a convention that makes us start in time. We need to have a certain social truth, a certain narrative we agree on, basically. And so we come to the realization that social truth is something that is always contested and always negotiated. It takes time to decide what are you going to say about the past. Damn, this society has 150 years discussing on the sense of the Civil War. They're still discussing, right? And I'm pretty sure other examples may appear and you will think of that. And what is obvious when you think of it is that when you discuss about the truth of those issues, of those historical issues, you're not discussing about physical facts of the world. And you're not discussing that because you want to establish an academic point. You discuss that because every historical narrative imparts prestige, legitimacy to a certain social order. If you lived in a British colony in the 40s or 50s, you probably would be an accommodated dweller of this little colony if you believed honestly that the sense of the British Empire was to spread freedoms around the world and to spread the protections of British rule of law all over the world. And that it was a wonderful fact that the British had taken the responsibility of civilizing so many peoples all over the world. I mean, you had to believe that in order to function well in that kind of colonial society in the 1940s or in 1775. So history is a narrative, as you know, and therefore is completely linked to our discussion on what is true or not. And therefore, when we discuss the truth of a certain event, what we are doing is we are destabilizing certain order, certain legitimacy. And therefore, we are going to have a discussion. We are going to have people come in and say, no, 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 that's not true. You are contradicting the truth. And that is, of course, very important in human history, because we all know the saying that says that winners write history. We are used to think of that. Whatever the justice of the cause of who won or who lost, you know, you think, well, the fact is we will never know, because in reality the ones who wrote history were the winners. It was not Spartacus who wrote history. Well, Hollywood made some justice to him. But it was not, you know, the slaves who wrote history in ancient Rome. It was the official, I don't know, what, scribes, I guess? Historians of the Caesars, right? And the reason why it's so difficult to find historiography about colonial peoples or people who were slaves or indigenous peoples or women or children is because they were never in any position to exercise hegemony in a society. They didn't write the books. So that is why a discussion of truth matters so much. And yet, we have an interesting issue happening in this particular time, in this particular era, which is that about 60, 65 years ago, at the end of the worst war we have ever had in recorded history, countries decided very, they were not completely decided, but sort of decided that they should respect certain basic rules. And among those basic rules, the most essential was that the legitimacy of a government is not some abstract notion of sovereignty over certain borders, but the way in which this government treats its citizens. And things that were completely unheard of started to happen, such as, for example, trying a government official, in fact, hanging a government official because of actions that were completely legal in his country, because his country was a criminal authoritarian regime. You know, when the Allies put Goering and Hess and Ribbentrop and all those people in trial in Nuremberg, their defense was, we're just following orders. And this was completely legal in our system. And what we do with our citizens is our issue, because we are a sovereign nation. You won, we lost. That's the only reason why you are sitting there. But that event and the development of law around that moment, which is the modern development of human rights law, which of course has also been happening in countries, which of course is reflected now in every modern country's constitution, makes more problematic for truth and for historical truth to be always narrated from the point of view of certain groups. Because the pleas of the victims of human rights violations cannot be simply disposed of. It is recognized now in international human rights law, and I would argue it is also a clear constitutional point in the constitutional law in the US or in any liberal society, that a victim of a serious crime has a clear right to a remedy, and that remedy has to be effective. So we are outraged when that remedy is denied. Now the question is, what does that remedy entail? Any jurist is going to tell you that remedy needs to be integral, that when you have a violation, the right of the person is to have his, her previous situation restored as much as possible, his, her human dignity restored as much as possible. And that's why, that's the sense why it's so important for any nation, deserving of the name, to have institutions of rule of law whose only task is to give remedy to people when their rights have been violated. And that remedy entails to seek justice, to seek reparation for damages. It's the whole reason why this country, for example, is so addicted to trials, and to know what happened. That's the sense of the expression a day in court. You have a right to be recognized as someone on whom these vexations, these aggravations, these violations should not have been visited. So, in international law, it is clearly recognized that for the worst human rights violations, and those are clearly indicated, for the worst human rights violations, there are three clear rights. And the first one is the right to know the facts about the violation. Of course, I have told you that to know the facts is a very relative construction. But you can always find, when you are talking about a specific kind of violation, a specific kind of social event, a crime, something that is also a very interesting construction: responsibilities. We, when we say we want to establish the facts about an event that was traumatic, an event that was violatory, an event that was an abuse, When we say we want the facts, we just don't want the description. So, you know, people were taken to an institution and mistreated in that institution. No, you just don't want to know that. When you say you want the facts, you also mean, and this was the result of a policy, and this was the result of an order, and this was the result of the action of somebody. The truth about an abuse, a traumatic event, a human rights violation, always entails a discussion on facts and actions and responsibilities, which is why we have this thing called courts of law. The essence of the ritual in a court of law is not to decide that something happened. Everybody knows the guy is killed. The victim is dead. That's not the point of what happens in a court of law. The point of what happens in a court of law is to decide whether the accused did it. And, moreover, whether the accused is actually responsible of doing it. Or whether the accused is insane or not morally responsible. And the point of a court of law is to determine, therefore, what? The truth about what happened. They are the first instrument of truth-seeking, courts of law, and the ones we take for granted. And because we take them for granted, we usually don't reflect on how they work. But when you think of it, what courts of law do is precisely that. They reconstruct the truth about a certain event following certain methodology. What is that methodology? Questions and answers, assessment of the witnesses, evaluation of something called evidence, the application of certain technical rules. Very complicated. You need an entire school of law to understand that, how they work. But you need specialists and specialized knowledge and specialized methodology to determine what happens. So we're not talking about the hour now. We're not talking about the time. We're talking about something very complicated. And the fact is, then, that just how complicated the ritual in a court is an indication of how complicated the truth about a social event is. You know, in a court of law, for example, that not all the truth about what happens is relevant. In a court of law, the only truth that is relevant is the one that you can prove. Therefore, the only testimony that is important is the one that is useful for the prosecution or for the defense. There may be many other testimonies and experiences and feelings that are irrelevant. And so, what we are going to discuss in the second part of this conversation is how do we go about trying to establish that truth that is so complicated, that has so many angles of entry. And what I would like to leave you with in this first part of the conversation is that we should think that, notwithstanding the fact that the truth about a social event is such a complex concept, and is probably not completely obtainable, even, you know, taking that into account, the fact is that when you have gone through such an event, when society has been affected by such an abuse, making the effort to reconstruct that story is your right. It's not just useful, it's also your right. And it has a number of elements that make it very important. First, the political, the social significance that I have been talking about. To discuss the truth about a certain social event destabilizes the way we feel about our society. makes us question the way this society is organized and ordered. Makes us think whether hierarchies, whether leaderships, whether hegemonies are in fact appropriate. Whether we should think differently about how are we organized. But on the other side, aside of the political aspect, which is extremely important, is also right. If you have a certain conviction that human beings have a certain dignity and that they are the object of the work of the state and not the other way around, then you have to recognize that when that human being is affected, you cannot deny that human being remedy, including this, the truth. So, truth matters because of these two dimensions. Because on the one side, it is politically significant. It can determine the way the population is going to understand the society they live in. It can have an effect on the way a society is organized. Truth can, definitely has, an effect on social change. And on the other side, because even without that consideration, it is a right. A victim, a survivor, has the right to revisit the situation in a protected environment, in a protected manner, in such a way that he or she will understand what happened. Why did it happen? Who was responsible for this? And seek appropriate remedy. If that was not a right, then you will have to take as normal, as okay, that, that some people's suffering is less important. You could say, oh, well, you know, we'll never make justice about sexual violence and domestic abuse because it's so pervasive. It's part of what happens. That's the way the world is organized. If you were to do that, if you were to say, we don't really need a space for victims of that kind of abuse to come and talk. If you were to say that, what you would be saying is the experience of women is less important than the experience of men. That's exactly what you would be saying. So, that is then this dual quality and this dual sense of importance that I think truth has. This presentation is a little bit abstract because it is a very abstract concept. But I think you can all see how rooted it is too. You can think of the examples. They're all around us. There is this wonderful poem by a German author called Bertolt Brecht, who, of course, you know. I just have to explain he's a German author because he's so forgotten. That's what happens with German authors, they get forgotten. But anyway, he has this very interesting reflection poem that is precisely about that. And I don't remember it exactly, but he mentions the different grandiose achievements of humanity and echoes that with a question. And he says something like, the wonderful walls of ancient Babylon, who built them? Or the golden Lima, where did the builders live? Caesar cried before his great battle. Was he the only one who cried? So that is the sense of the discussion. And I think that is the sense of revisiting the truth. So I propose that this is the first part of the conversation. Is that okay? Mm-hmm. All right. What do we do, Donna? Should we open the floor?
to do.
No, we can
skip it.
Okay, good. Excellent. Good morning, everybody. My name is Jackie Lindsay, and I'm working with the Boston Busing Desegregation Project. And before we begin this next section, which is about your questions and Eduardo's responses, because we got off to a late start, I was just checking with Eduardo to see if he needed to take a break, and he says it's okay to skip it. So of course, any of you who need to take one at any time can, but we also want to stay on target here so that we can fully hear also the next part. This part of the discussion will have about almost 15 minutes to hear what questions you have for Eduardo about his presentation. And before we begin, let me just say this. There are people in this room who have been at some of our previous events, so that we can best use why we have Eduardo here, I'd like you to keep your questions focused on what he presented. So, for example, this is not the time to get into the whole history of the Boston busing desegregation crisis. This is the time for us to learn about truth projects around the world. And this first part of Eduardo's presentation really focused on, as he says, what is truth seeking? So based on what you heard, what questions do you have for Eduardo? Yes, ma'am.
I have a question.
And could you identify yourself first?
Oh, Marlene Vine.
Okay, thanks.
I have a question about the construction of the narrative. So if we're talking about seeking truth, and we put that in the context of seeking a new narrative of social events, is that then a narrative which attempts to pull together accounts from all sides, including those in power?
That is a question. What we are seeking to do is not necessarily, I want to challenge you to think not just in terms of what this narrative is going to say at the end of the exercise, that is, what is going to be the end result, the alternative narrative to the existing one, but I want to challenge you to think of the process. That is, how are we going to do it? And that's the sense of your question, right? First thing, why it's important to think in terms of process, is because in the same way in which the official truth can be very authoritarian, you just don't want, if you really want a process of change or democratization, you just don't want to replace it with another official truth.
Right.
What would be the sense of that? Right? So we did have this truth about group X being irresponsible, poor, and responsible for all bad things that happen to them. Now we're going to change it exactly the opposite way. That is not going to really make it. The reality is that even when you make an exercise of putting together an alternative explanation, alternative narratives, there is always a risk of ignoring certain groups. When I was working in the Peruvian Truth Commission, we did go to indigenous communities that had suffered during the civil war in Peru, both the aggressions of the Shining Path, a terrorist organization, and the state and the government. And something really funny happened. When you interviewed the community in a group, you came with a very perfect organized narrative. And there was not a single community in the whole region that had supported the Shining Path ever. Everyone was there as a victim. The Shining Path came out of nowhere, some kind of Martians who killed lots of people, and then the community heroically rose up and defeated them in the name of democracy. Once you asked the women, the widows, the poorer in the community, you found a more complicated story. So definitely you want to do a process of getting the truth that is more inclusive than the inexistent process by which the existing truth has been created. Now, that has, of course, a problem. The problem is that if your process is really democratic, really inclusive, you are going to be forced to hear the other versions you don't like.
Right.
And you are going to have to sit down and negotiate a mechanism for discussing this and hearing this. And so that's an intrinsic problem. You can, of course, always do the first thing. We want to replace that insatisfactory truth by a completely satisfactory truth. If you do that, that's probably a psychologically adequate and important moment. But the effectiveness of that socially is going to be limited. You can have this exercise purely for the purposes of healing. And typically, when you want to heal, you meet with people that have suffered the same thing that you had suffered. You share that, and you feel confirmed and acknowledged. That's excellent, and it's important to do that. But it's not where we are aiming at. And which is why, when we start discussing the how of truth seeking, we are going to discuss precisely this issue. So how do you build objectivity when you have to deal with stories that are so different? And the reality is that it is not so relative. The relativism is not that enormous. You know, even people who are benefited by the current narrative, if they have the space, the right methodology to really discuss the issues, start recognizing the limitations of that kind of story. And when you have, on top of that, not just a narrative about long historical processes, but about crimes, about abuses, about specific situations that are undeniable, then that exercise gets to be pretty positive, pretty important. And I would say also at a tactical level, it's very important to have the widest possible collection of versions around the table. Because when you finish the exercise, when you agree on something that is going to definitely be different from what exists now, you want some buy-in from the other sectors too. You want to convince them that they should come here because there is going to be another version. It's in your interest to come in. And at the end of the process, you want some people to say, well, yeah, we cannot really deny that. There were people who represented our point of view in that commission, in that exercise, in that meeting. That is, in fact, the experience of many truth commissions around the world. They look horrible at the beginning because, you know, they are created with the presence of pro-apartheid people in South Africa. No, you have President Mandela himself appointed a number of white nationalists to be members of that truth commission. There were Pinochet supporters in the Chilean Truth Commission. There was a former minister of Mr. Fujimori in the Peruvian Truth Commission. Well, the reason why that is important is because their experiences are also part of the reality, that is true, but also tactically, because you want to give to everyone, if possible, guarantees that this is going to be impartial. And it's not going just to be a representation of your aspirational truth to replace the other one.
Okay. Let's see if we can take another question. I see another hand over here. Alexander?
I just wanted to ask a question for clarity. When you named Sendero Luminoso, were you naming them a terrorist organization, or were you saying that's how they were characterized?
No, I'm saying they were a terrorist organization.
Are we having a debate about the truth? Sorry about that. But clearly, Alexander, did you have a follow-up? Because otherwise...
Yeah, because I thought I might have been mishearing you, but that's, I mean, I don't live in Peru, but they had a different... They had Sendero Luminoso, from my knowledge of them, had things other than being terrorists. That there was something else to characterize them as Sendero Luminoso, a terrorist organization.
Okay, let me give you the characterization that the Truth Commission used. The Shining Path, the Communist Party of Peru Shining Path, was a political organization bent on the creation of an authoritarian regime, and that used systematically war crimes and crimes against humanity in order to achieve its objective, which under the legislation of Peru and international legislation is called terrorism and terrorism actions. Not just the Shining Path was terrorist in Peru, the armed forces were also terrorists.
Okay, so they also used that. Also terrorist.
Exactly. When I use the concept, I'm not just hanging a label or an adjective to the noun. Right? I am using it in a description of the kind of tactics and objectives that the organization follows.
Yes, and then yes, yes.
Good morning. I have a question around, I think, in terms of Israel-Palestine, because I work in that area.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering about the legal versus the social purpose, perhaps, of having some kind of, and it may not be a TRC, but some kind of discussion of mutual narratives. So, because you mentioned healing, and what I took from what you said is that the purpose of healing is different from the purpose of getting a legal outcome.
Mm-hmm.
And then my question is that when you want to bring people together to hear each other's narrative for the purpose of, let's say, healing or understanding, that might be prior to an assessment of responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
Or of the people in power, because if you take the people, the Israelis and Palestinians, there's a discussion to be had aside from the policymakers, let's say. So is there I think there's a process of discussing narratives together.
Mm-hmm.
Not sure if that would lead to the people in power admit assuming responsibility, or even one of the parties there assuming some, or that we both bear responsibility. So is it right? So is there a sequence here, and is there some also negotiation of identity? Because we're all coming together saying we're victims. We get there.
We don't know whether, I mean, we can imagine an ideal form to produce this discussion. An ideal form could, for example, have, in the example you have mentioned, first people talking for the purposes of psychological catharsis and healing, hearing other people as a way to build confidence between communities, and then going into the complicated political issues. And when you think of a situation as entrenched as the conflict in the Middle East, for example, or the conflict in Colombia, which is also almost 70 years old now, you know, you want to think, well, perhaps it's not enough to just get together and create a truth commission from zero. You will need certain confidence building process first. And that confidence building process may entail focusing on other levels, other aspects of this truth. Perhaps you are not going to start discussing, so who was guilty of the situation we are in? Perhaps you want to start by, so what has been your experience about living in this situation? So, but the reality is that even if we can theoretically say perhaps this would be the best way of starting, in the real world, we don't always have the possibility of choosing. Right? A peace process in the Middle East, if that existed, right? I don't think it does, but anyway, that existed, would probably look very different from the peace process in Nepal, or the post-military transition in Chile, or the post-apartheid transition in South Africa. Each given situation looks different and gives you a different room for maneuver. So in some cases, you simply don't have time for a very long process. Think of the Tunisian or the Egyptian transformations. You know that they are perhaps going to be experiencing this democratic springtime for what, 6 months? 7? These processes are very short, very intense, but very short. At some point they close and you go back to normal. And so sometimes these truth exercises are rushed because you want to take them and to organize them as fast as you can, not to miss the train.
Okay.
It happened to us in Peru. The government of Mr. Fujimori collapsed. The dictator took a plane and escaped the country. And we had a little transitional government that lasted exactly 8 months. So we knew we have to create this truth commission right now, because we don't know what is going to happen when the masses are no longer in the street exercising pressure. Mm-hmm. Right? So we better act now. And so I would say perhaps my presentation was too focused on the legal and political aspects of the truth, but it is very clear that a third important aspect is a psychological one. We don't know yet, we don't know, you know, recognizing that those three pillars and forms to approach the truth exist, we don't know whether there is a better methodology. You do this first and this other first, or you attack the elephant from all sides. We don't know that. It sounds like in a situation as difficult as the one you're mentioning, perhaps we want to go part by part. But again, it's a matter of contextual evaluation, in my view.
Paul has the last question, and Paul, if we can be brief, because we're moving into your next section.
Just a structural question. I was wondering how your model accommodates dynamics where the narrative is imposed by the losers, as in the lost cause thing from the century or so after the U.S. Civil War, where the southern side of events became pretty much the received wisdom until the early to late 60s.
Good question.
It's true. Well, I don't know the answer to that, but the example you're mentioning is very interesting because it shows that the truth about an event is not ever safe. That historical truths are never completely enshrined. Because in reality, I mean, you're completely right. The first time I came to the United States, this was, I don't know, 50 years ago perhaps, I remember I visited Virginia. And I go to Charlottesville, it's probably Charlottesville, yeah. And I see this big statue to General Lee. Look, I come from a country where rebels don't have statues. Moreover, people get angry at us because we call them terrorists. You see the point? I was completely surprised. I was totally surprised. How is it possible that a guy who fought against the integrity of the country I'm visiting, and moreover in favor of enslaving part of the population of the country I'm visiting, has a statue? For me, it was completely alien.
Isn't
it funny? So, but the interesting thing is that I thought, well, this cannot have been the narrative the day immediately after Appomattox. This cannot have been the narrative in 1865, in 1866. Something must have happened between that and the moment of the erection of this statue.
It's called counter-revolution.
Call it, you know, in some way or another, but the fact is that something happened. And it means that the understanding of that process, of that particular event, is very plastic. And it's completely linked to the way in which the American society has changed, I won't say evolved, changed in terms of relations between races, in terms of relations between classes, in terms of relations, in terms of hegemonies, obviously. I mean, it would be impossible, I think, for a great studio to film Gone with the Wind today, and certainly not Birth of a Nation. Right? That was possible until, what, 1930-something, right? When is Gone with the Wind from? I mean, it's a great movie, don't get me wrong, but...
No, 38.
Yeah, but, you know, I don't think that the heroine would be, you know, this southern belle who is all proud of the red land of Tara, right? I don't think that would be happening now, because we see that history completely differently. And even that is changing all the time. And another interesting thing about it is that you see how history is really not something that happens in faculties of history. But it's something that is happening in popular culture all the time. We have some other circuits of communication going on here that we need to be very attentive to. Because it's not just something that appears in a journal or in a book. It's the ways these journals and books are being digested, discussed, transmitted through history, to family history, through popular narratives, through what people and children say in school. And what Hollywood is saying too. Right? You know, the history of desegregation, busing, civil rights, that is not told according to how it was lived in Boston. It's told according to how it was lived in Selma, somewhere else. Right? So then what is the true story? That is what we are going to be discussing. So you, okay, let's move to the other point. And now we have cut down the delay to just a few minutes.
Yes. Mm-hmm.